Welcome back to The Real Big Show. My name is Michael Petrelli, playing the role of the Doctor for all you Whovians. We've regenerated the Cinnamon Podcast to take the form here on Real News Daily. The name has changed, but the spirit is strong as ever. I'm joined by my companions, if you will, dial in from Melissa and creator of Real News Daily, our very own Melissa Hansen. What's up?
Hello.
And joining us after a short absence from the great state of Georgia, Mr. Brad Slayton. Brad, welcome back.
Hey, woohoo, real news, kick ass.
So today, to celebrate the move over to our new home, Real News Daily, a site run by two kick-ass women, and our new name, The Real Big Podcast, our topic for the evening will be about kick-ass female characters in the sci-fi genre.
Ooh.
But first, after we give you a little special treat. So I had a chance to sit down and interview director Jonathan English for his upcoming medieval action film Ironclad, Battle for Blood, which debuts on VOD and iTunes this Friday. We had a chance to talk a little bit about the film and its connection to the original Ironclad. Let's hear what he had to say. So we are joined today by director Jonathan English, whose new film, Ironclad, Battle for Blood, hits VOD this Friday. So Jonathan, a year has passed since the siege of Rochester Castle. We find Guy the Squire, a seemingly different man from when we previously saw him in the last film. What can you tell us about where Guy's psychological profile is at this point?
Well, he's become a medieval mercenary knight or fighter, which was common in the period of the Middle Ages, that young men would turn to being hired mercenaries, and they would go off to wars in France and, you know, around England. They would be hired to fight castles and sieges and things. So he's a young man that's seen a lot of action, a lot of battling and fighting wars, etc. And he's obviously affected by it. You know, he's got a form of post-traumatic shock, I suppose. This is coming off the back of the siege of Rochester as well. And he's closed off, and he's like a lot of soldiers, really, at this point. I mean, the medieval version.
So Tom Austin takes over the role as Guy for the new film. What type of dynamic did Tom bring to the role that you felt was needed for Guy's change of character?
He's a very iconic young actor. You know, he's got a really classic movie star quality of, like, the old type. I mean, you know, he sort of reminded me of people like Clint Eastwood and Mel Gibson in Mad Max, or Clint Eastwood in the spaghetti western films. I wanted somebody with a really strong physical presence that would have a real physical strength, but also a kind of a hardness, a determination, you know. That's a harder thing to get on film, actually, than one imagines. When you see the way sort of Mel Gibson did it in the early Mad Max films, where he's this very cold character, but still very watchable. And I felt that Tom, had that quality and has a great career ahead of him.
So you have a new mix of seasoned characters and fresh faces in this new film. What was it like to put the cast together? Was it important to have such a dynamic mix of fresh and seasoned?
Yes, I mean, it's always great when you can give younger, newer actors an opportunity to have, you know, good roles in a movie amongst an ensemble of more seasoned actors. And I think that's a smart way to cast the film. If you have the opportunity, if you have the chance, the flexibility to cast a movie in that way, it's a great way to work. Because you're sort of energy to the cast, but you're also getting the real experience and gravitas that really seasoned actors have. And a lot of the actors in this, like with the first film, you know, we had the opportunity to work with some really seasoned British actors, great talent, people like Michelle Fairley and, you know, and some of the other cast members from Game of Thrones, David Paves, who is a newer actor on film, but is a very experienced actor on television and in theatre, and, you know, David's an amazing talent. So all round, I mean, there's a lot of actors to mention, but all round, I was really happy with the way the cast came together.
So the last film, the foe was the tyrant King John. This time we find a clan of Celtic tribesmen pillaging their way across the lands. How do you feel that these foes differ in your mind? And is there one more ruthless than the other to you?
That's a good question. I mean, I guess you have to say that King John was a, you know, he's one of the all-time great villains, really. He's been a villain in so many Robin Hood movies and so many other stories. So, and when he's played by an actor of the stature of Paul Giamatti, you know, it was, I think it was a real, one of the real successes of the first film was the combination of the character and Paul's, getting Paul to play him. But I'm really happy with the way the Celtic, the Scottish clan, have come together in this film. And, you know, I think they provide a great, enemy and a great force of, you know, antagonism for our heroes. Yes, very happy.
Okay, last question, please.
So, revenge is a strong theme for these two films. In Battle of Blood, both sides lose a key figure to their cause. Another strong theme is honor. There's a lot of references to fighting for family. Both can lead...
Sorry, I could just say the last thing again, please?
Yeah, so another strong theme is honor, and there's many references to fighting for family. Both can lead a character to make decisions that impact everyone around them. Do you feel that revenge and honor are worthy motivations to go to war?
Revenge and honor, are they worthy motivations to go to war? I mean, they are certainly reasons that people have gone to war. You know, that's for sure. I think there are many other reasons as well. I think there are strategic reasons for going to war. But for these characters, you know, I mean, Guy's motivation is it changes, of course. I mean, that's the important thing about the journey of his character. He starts off going to war for money because he's a hired mercenary, but in the end, he rejects the money and fights for family, for blood, for honor, you know, but for family more than anything, because he finds himself and he comes home. The Scottish clan are predominantly fighting for, the leader of the clan is fighting for revenge, as you say, but essentially the clan themselves are fighting because they've lost their lands and they're trying to win them back, you know, which is a fairly old historical reason for many countries and groups of people going to war to reclaim what they've lost. You know, it's a big topic, but I think they're justifiable reasons, but there are always many. And I mean, is any kind of war justifiable in the end?
That's true.
I think while this movie is a very commercial action adventure film and there's a lot of fighting, I think that in this film, as in the first film, there's also a question, there's also a message, which is, you know, is war beneficial? Is it worth it in the end? And I think you have to say often not. The price is too high.
Last question. Are there plans for an Ironclad 3, and where do you hope to take these characters next?
There's certainly plans and there's discussion, but no decisions yet about the characters, whether it would be the same characters or again a shift. But certainly there is discussion about Ironclad 3, yes.
Great. Well, Jonathan, I thank you for your time. Accelerated Media will be releasing Ironclad Battle for Blood on VOD on July 11th, and it hits theaters on July 25th. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, Michael. Pleasure to see you.
Thank you. Thanks, Jonathan, for taking some time out of your day to speak with us, and I hope that everyone gets a chance to see Ironclad Battle for Blood. It debuts on VOD and iTunes this Friday, July 11th, and it hits theaters on July 25th. Now on to the topic of the evening. In a genre dominated by male leads, sci-fi and fantasy has been a tough nut to crack for female characters in the early years. In the early years, female characters in science fiction, fantasy, and otherwise have been predominantly there for sex appeal. But throughout the years, Hollywood has wised up and given us some of the greatest characters in cinematic history. And yes, these women are still as beautiful as ever. But now, they can kick your ass while you're looking at them. So tonight, we pay tribute to the greatest of the greats. So, I will bring up this question to the both of you. It took until May 25th, 1977, so like a whole 77 years in creation of human life, when a little-known actress named Carrie Fisher starred in an iconic movie called Star Wars, for us to truly find our first strong female character in science fiction fantasy, Princess Leia. What was it about Princess Leia that differed from characters in sci-fi fantasy of the past? Brad.
Ooh, did my board make it over from the move? Like, did you bring my board?
I did.
Good. Wonderful. Here we go. Blasphemy number one for this new site. I rewatched Star Wars in anticipation, the unchanged Lucas version. It's not a good movie. I watched it. I was just like, wow, it's nothing like I remembered it. Like, so clunky, and Princess Leia didn't hold up for me. And then I went back and watched Barbarella, and I was like, wow, Jane Fonda kicks ass. You know?
That's true.
I was like, I'm going Jane Fonda instead of Carrie Fisher. I was like, it did not. Now, I watched Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. Empire Strikes Back was great, but I was trying to get anything out of the original Star Wars, and I was like, wow, this is really bad. Like, I was hurt. Like, I guess, I don't know what, maybe my childhood was different, but it's like, wow, this is not good.
Melissa, did Princess Leia resonate with you when you were growing up?
You know, not really. I mean, I liked it. She was sort of snarky, and but I still thought that she was sort of, it was just, she was kind of a token character. Like, oh, they needed a woman in there, so they had put her in there. I mean, and you know, I love the dynamic between her and and Han, but I don't know. I never thought of her as like a kick-ass sort of thing. I wish she would have like been more, because I really liked in Empire Strikes Back where she's, you know, like she's in charge of everything, you know, but she's not authoritative enough for me. I don't know. I'm definitely for the first real, you know, woman in a sci-fi movie, you know, great start. But I think we've come a long way since then in ways and not in others.
And what's up with making out with your brother? I mean,
I know.
That's geez, leave that to Polanski. I mean,
I'm pretty sure Christ. He has like that fetish going on in his head, doesn't he?
I get, maybe that's why he sold to Disney. Mm. You know, he was like, they can handle this better than I can.
I know, they have penises on their little mermaid castles.
Oh Lord!
Yeah, they're normal.
Yeah, well, you know. And, you know, clouds spell out obscene words in The Lion King, right?
Yeah. Well, a couple years later, Ridley Scott unleashed one of my favorite characters of all time, Sigourney Weaver's Ellen Ripley, on audiences in the original Alien film, which would go on to spawn, of course, multiple sequels. Ripley was a unique character who brought a different dimension to the female lead. What were the traits that Sigourney Weaver brought to Alien that made her character so appealing, Mel?
I think for me, it's the reluctant hero. I mean, she was not in charge when the movie starts out. You know, she's number two, and just through things that happen, you know, suddenly she's the one that has to make the decisions, and she just steps up to the plate. So I think that's one of the traits that is good is that she's, you know, instantly just takes charge.
Brad, did Ripley change the face of female characters moving forward after Alien?
You know, I don't really think so because, I mean, she might have, but I just view it, I view her character kind of androgynous. Like, I don't think there was the huge push of like, ooh, look, it's a female. Like, I think it was just all people versus an alien, and she's just someone that happened to survive. Like, I don't think they made this huge push, which they would in the later films, of, ooh, look, she's a badass female. Like, I don't think that was Ridley Scott's, you know, goal to have a badass female. Like, I think it just kind of resonated with viewers.
Yeah, but I think that that's the question that I'm asking, is that since the female characters of the past were always in, like, bikinis and wearing weird voodoo shit and, like, lighty things and were really there for more sex appeal, she was there, you know, in that, you know, long pants and overall jumpsuit and like, just she wasn't your typical, like, you know, female sci-fi star at that point. And moving forward, it seems like that I think Ridley saw something that Sigourney, you know, offered. And I think that her portrayal of Ellen Ripley kind of catapulted what we would see moving forward for females in sci-fi.
Yeah, because everybody wanted to be badass. Yeah. But, you know, I mean, I agree with what Brad says, because it's not – her gender was not an issue in Alien.
Well, that's what I think.
Yeah, it was purely like, this is a character and this is what this character is going through.
Yeah.
And I think that's what's the great part about it, really.
Yeah, because you made a good point, Melissa, with the, you know, Carrie Fisher and Princess Leia obviously being a female, you know, and
mm-hmm.
I guess we answered both our own questions. Great job, Petrelli.
Sweet. So after a series of step backs for strong female characters in sci-fi in the early 80s, I'm not going to get into them. In 1984, James Cameron brought the Terminator to the big screen, headed up by, of course, a male actor, Arnold Schwarzenegger. The film virtually catapulted a newcomer, Linda Hamilton, into spotlight, and she starred as the mother of the Resistance, Sarah Connor. Her character was interesting as she began the film as she was more of a character running for her life that turned into a woman standing up and fighting to survive. So I guess I wonder, since James Cameron worked on both franchises, do you think Ellen Ripley and Sarah Connor have the same DNA? Meaning, are they carbon copies of one another?
I don't think so. Because, you know, Sarah Connor's essentially like a barmaid, isn't she? And, I mean, really, I mean, Sigourney Weaver wasn't betting Michael Biehn. You know what I mean? Like, all she essentially did in the first Terminator was hit a button. You know, Terminator 2, she's all like, she's got backstage passes to Lilith Fair by Terminator 2. You know? Like, she's hanging...
Wow.
She's hanging with Melissa Etheridge backstage, you know, Sarah Connor is. But the first one, you know, that's up until the final, like, 5 minutes, it's all Michael Biehn versus Arnold, you know. She's just like, what the heck's happening? I mean, essentially her main role in the first Terminator is a concubine for, you know, the future leader. That's... You know, until the end, where she just pushes a button and squashes Arnold, which is the most ridiculous ending I've ever seen. Here we go, another one for the board. James Cameron's the Antichrist to me. I hate him. I absolutely loathe James Cameron with a passion. I'm compiling a book on why he's the Antichrist.
I'm gonna skip right over that. Mel, did Linda Hamilton, Sarah Connor succeed because of the effects of Sigourney Weaver's Ellen Ripley?
No, I don't think so. I don't think they have anything to do with one another, really. I mean, like Brad said in the first movie, they're basically two different characters, honestly. Because they're not even, they have the same name and same supposed, like, you know, role. But really, in the first one, she's just a, you know, scared woman running from here to there. Not, you know, and she's annoying, basically, in the first one, in my opinion. And, you know, in the second one, she's suddenly this badass, you know, militant woman who they sort of explain it a little bit, but they don't really explain her character arc at all. It's just basically like, oh, yeah, you know, she found out that, you know, she's has the son, and now so now she's got to train him. And I'm like, why would she be doing that? The woman from the first movie would not be training her son. The woman from the first movie would be hiding her son and would be, like, trying to shelter him from all this stuff. So
they kind of explain that this
essentially.
They kind of explain that, I mean, in a way, but I think...
You could essentially...
Go ahead, Brad.
Oh, sorry. You could essentially say that James Cameron went and directed Aliens, and then was like, ooh, look what I have in Sigourney Weaver with Ripley, and then that part of Ripley in Aliens, where she's in a gigantic mechanical Pacific Rim suit, that bullish masculine female part made the... Sarah Connor for T2.
Maybe.
That's what I was thinking is really what I was kind of trying to drive to. I was going to say, let's skip over Terminator 1 because I think we have kind of stabilized the fact that she was a non-strong character in that one movie. Second one, she was, like you said, she was all of a sudden a UFC fighter ready to kick some ass.
Which essentially proves that James Cameron has no originality whatsoever in his body because he just carries stuff over. And remakes Ferngully.
What? Oh, Avatar.
Yeah, there we go. With Sigourney Weaver. See, it all ties in, people. It's a circle of life.
It's a circle of life.
Oh, my God.
Where's our Disney maven when we need her?
I know.
Well, so one place where strong female science fiction and fantasy characters has thrived is television. So from Star Trek to X-Files, there's been so many memorable female leads. Either one of you have like a few characters that resonated with you watching TV when you were growing up? I'm going to throw one out. Buffy.
See, I was never a Buffy fan.
I would say Buffy as in Christy Swanson, Buffy. Damn right. You know, essentially all the female women from Firefly.
Absolutely. 100% agree with you.
They were all badass.
Yeah, I think Liz mentioned that too.
Scully?
Firefly.
Scully was, pardon my language, Melissa, Scully was just a bitch.
Like, always.
Well, yeah, but the balance, well, I think the balance between her and Mulder was, I mean, that was genius, just their character, yeah.
But just constantly
but by herself,
naysaying.
Yeah,
she's just, you really saw it when Robert Patrick came in, you know, like, and replaced David Duchovny for, what was it, like 2 seasons?
Yeah.
Like, that was horrible because she could do nothing. Like, Duchovny kind of carried her.
Well,
you know?
They were partners, yeah.
Yeah.
They couldn't, yeah.
How about, the girl who played Starbuck on Battlestar Galactica. I wasn't a big fan of Battlestar Galactica, but I know that the change of that character really kind of at the beginning was purists of the original Battlestar Galactica were up in arms that they changed Starbuck to a female character. But from what I've heard, her character was actually really well received after people actually sat down and watched it. I might add that to the list. Even though I'm going to have to go back and watch some Battlestar Galactica.
Was that Jeri Ryan's character?
No. That was she was in Star Trek, wasn't she? Star Trek DS9?
I'm not a big Star Trek fan.
I don't know.
How about the companions from the Doctor Who series? I mean, they're always pretty strong-willed, I would say.
I've never seen an episode of Doctor Who in my life.
Yeah, me either. Liz would be speaking up right now, but sorry.
We suck, Michael.
I know.
We'll just put our heads down in shame.
Damn it, Liz, where are you? So anyway, in the 1990s, there was a sort of lull in the expansion of memorable female leads until The Matrix changed the game. Trinity, played by Carrie Ann Moss, took the best of the female characters in the past and redefine cool. What similarities did Trinity have to other similar characters, and what set her apart? Ooh. Either one of you.
What set her apart was she was actually attractive.
Oh, come on.
Yeah. Oh, dude, seriously. Tell me you find Sigourney Weaver attractive.
She's pretty.
Really?
And it doesn't matter. This is kick-ass, not...
Yes, but, you know, do you watch female boxing?
No.
Exactly.
I don't watch boxing.
Well, I don't... She was just a cool character, and she could kick ass, you know? But she's something... You know, with the way people are so, like, looks-obsessed with Hollywood, like, 99% would rather watch an attractive woman kick ass than, you know, a skinny, rail-thin, like, manly-jawed woman.
Mel, please save me. Trinity, have at it.
You know, I didn't really care for Trinity, honestly. I thought it was when she started out, it was amazing. And then all of a sudden, you know, oh, she's the one that's supposed to fall in love. And I'm like, what kind of bullshit is that? I was like, seriously? I was like, why did that have to be? Like, that really just sort of annoyed me. Like, so I don't consider her to be a kick-ass character. She has some kick-ass parts, definitely. The beginning, you know, that whole sequence is amazing. And I wish there was a lot more of that. I don't understand why it just had to be her being the one. I mean, they could have shown a lot more with Switch. I thought she was very interesting. I thought she was very entertaining. I mean, I don't know. I mean, Joe Pantoliano, I love him, but he always plays that sort of character. So it was just like, kind of like, ugh, again?
Yeah.
I only saw the first one.
I'm not saying anything. I really enjoyed the movie. I still really enjoy the movie. But I don't really consider it to be a kick-ass female character.
Well, I do. So that's all that matters.
We are really tanking.
I am sorry, Michael.
There you go. So we'll just move on here. So the female characters have thrived in comic books in the last 14 years. Is there is this the only genre ripe for great female characters, or can sci-fi actually find a way to keep up?
I think the whole reason all this, you know, female characters for comics, it's because men are still writing the female characters. There's not women writing the female characters. So it's still going to be like the idealized fantasy of this kick-ass, you know, this chick who's completely, you know, not doesn't have the physical presence, but yet can do all the physical work, sort of a thing.
I would agree with you that males dominate the comic book genre, but there are a lot of females that are writing sci-fi now. It's just that those are the novels that don't get out there.
Well, right, exactly. Yeah. They're not getting picked up. You know what? I swear to God, they should go back to pen names.
Yeah, why not? There's got to be great. There's some great female sci-fi writers out there that are just not getting their due.
Yeah. It's horrible that, you know, it would still have to come to that in this day and age. But, I mean, it's just the idea that they don't, you know, think that they can write anything like that. But, you know, they're out there.
Well, I'll tell you one place that's females, and I'm sure that this will resonate with Mr. Slayton over there.
Oh, it is.
Video games.
Oh, always geez, had small
please. Email leads.
Are you kidding me?
Man, here we go. Studios have been mining these games to create film franchises. Can video games truly translate well to film with these characters like Resident Evil, Tomb Raider, etc.?
No.
Is it harder to adapt a novel or a video game, do you think, Mel?
Harder to adapt? Oh, it's harder to adapt a novel.
Well, I'm thinking from the worlds, the standpoint of looking at the worlds that they build for these video games.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think it's kind of like when people play these video games, they have their mindset on what they want to see on a film. and they don't get all that. What they like, they think they're going to get this eye candy that they're not getting. I think it, that's when it fails, is that they're like, with a book, you can adapt it and you can kind of take liberties, and people will go, whoa, that wasn't in the book. Well, but they can still make a good movie. I think people that play video games sometimes run, you know, find themselves running into the thought of, well, I play this game every day, and this is not the world that I see, that kind of thing.
I hadn't thought about it that way. I totally get that point. Yeah, I mean, I think that they're probably just have their equal but different limitations.
So, Brad, can it can they find a way to find a way to translate these great female characters or male, it doesn't matter, but to film?
I don't think so, because they're too a video game is mindless entertainment. Unless you're playing, I'm not a gamer or anything. I mean, I had an NES back in the day, you know, when I was a kid. But video games are video games. That's solely what they are. I mean, that's like saying, could you take Marco Polo and put Will Smith and Tom Cruise in it and have them play Marco Polo in a feature film? No, it's not made for a feature film. Just let it be a video game. These companies are so corrupt of ideas that they just throw a woman in black spandex and have her do 80 flips over a horde of zombies. And they're like, yep, $100 million, woohoo, you know? It's flipping ridiculous. But to go back to your comic book thing, I got to say Lori Geary with Tank Girl. That was the strongest female character.
I did enjoy Tank Girl quite a bit.
Lori Petty.
Yeah.
Lori Petty, sorry.
Lori Petty, yeah.
Yeah, she's awesome, you know? Like, she was great in Tank Girl, and that was a good female comic. You know,
it was.
So
is it safe to say from both of you that video game adaptations haven't really truly provided a strong female kick-ass character yet for the screen?
Yeah, you won't see me on a sentiment board going for a Resident Evil 7 passes.
I mean, I enjoyed the first Resident Evil, but I just found her outfit to be utterly ridiculous, but I'm sure that's what she wore in the video game, so that's probably why she's wearing that. I never saw Tomb Raider, because I could not stand her face in that movie for some reason. It just annoyed me. But I'm sure she kicked ass in that movie.
Yeah.
Catwoman in Batman Returns. I loved Michelle Pfeiffer. I mean, I don't know if you'd consider that sci-fi. It's fantasy, maybe.
Yeah.
That's what I think of. It's like, yeah, I like that. She was good in that.
So will Hollywood ever find a decent balance of female lead and male lead franchises?
Friggin' hope so. I mean, Lucy's coming out. Lucy comes out in August. I'm looking forward to seeing that.
I've heard some amazing reviews of that so far. So
yeah. I look forward to seeing that, too.
Scarlett Johansson rocks in Under the Skin. That's a kick-ass
movie.
I need
to see that.
Yes, she's definitely kicking ass in that movie. If you're going sci-fi and kick-ass females, I'd have to throw out Natasha Henstridge in the Species series.
Oh, my goodness.
Like,
yeah.
Even though she's a villain, how much more kick-ass can you possibly be?
God, I mean, such a terrible movie.
Oh, I love Species.
I'm with you on it. I love Species too, but it's so terrible.
Yeah. But hey, Ben Kingsley and Alfred Molina, you know?
Oh, my God, right. Oh, wow, yeah.
And Michael Madsen, when he actually was decent at acting.
Whew. He was?
Yeah, he was good then. He wasn't on crystal meth or anything at that point, I don't believe.
Okay, good. So is there an actress right to lead the strong charge for female roles in sci-fi fantasy? Not drama or comedy, but like this type of genre at this point?
You know, I think ScarJo could do it if she put her mind to it. I mean, she Black Widow was the character in Avengers?
Yep.
I mean, besides that ridiculous hair, she was, you know, she was good in that. And she was very convincing at it. She's kicking ass in Lucy coming up. I think she could have potential as that.
Is she getting a little older for this role, or do you think that she's in the prime right now?
Oh, she's in her prime.
Okay.
Yeah.
Brad, is there any females that you've watched lately that you think, damn, she could be this, that, or the other thing in sci-fi?
You know, the problem with sci-fi right now is it takes itself too damn serious. Like, it needs to get back to the kind of hokey stuff and not be all gloom and doom. So, in regards to that aspect, I would love to see Melissa McCarthy do, like, 8 flips over a horde of aliens and then just go all Jackie Chan on them. And because with CGI, you could do that. Like, let's take it back to that. I mentioned Barbarella. You know, Barbarella came from another world. Like, all those, like, weird sci-fi movies with, like, lobster creatures and stuff like that. And, you know, women who don't even look like they could do a push-up. Like, let's have them kick ass. Because sci-fi is meant to be kind of goofy. I mean, look at the beginning credits of the Rocky Horror Picture Show, you know, with the song. It's not talking about... And Sigourney Weaver did 80 pull-ups on a bar and then kicked ass with a karate kick. You know, it's talking about, like, the female villains. Like, sci-fi was pulpy, you know? It was like the EC Comics type stuff. So let's get back to utter ludicrousness because there's too much drama in the real world. Like, we need an escape, and we don't need an escape of Tom Cruise firing 80 machine guns at a bunch of robots. Like, we need ridiculousness. So let's put Melissa McCarthy in there.
How about Emily Blunt?
Oh, I like her. I don't like her as action, but I do like her. She was okay in Looper. I really enjoyed her in Looper, but that wasn't like an action part, an action role. I didn't see Edge of Tomorrow. I probably should see it just to be able to argue that point a little bit better. But I just I don't really see her as an action star.
Could Abigail Breslin pull it off now that she's coming of age, you think? I mean, she has that kind of hardened, soft look.
No, but the chick who played Hit Girl.
Oh, yeah. But she's looking more womanly now.
Chloe, you know, like, yeah. Chloe Moretz.
Mint.
Put the Olsen twins in one, you know?
Oh, my God.
Well... This has been amazing. Awesome conversation.
Are we done?
We are done.
Oh, man.
This awesome conversation, the one that we will have next week, which will be the Yang to my Yin, best male sci-fi fantasy characters. You don't want to miss our choices. Hopefully we'll have Melissa and Brad back to give me their pithy observations. Ooh. Make sure to check. What?
Oh, sorry. I was going to throw one in that I completely forgot, and I was, like, talking to someone about today. Alyssa Jones from Chasing Amy has got to be the greatest sci-fi female character of all time. Because Kevin Smith says that as a sci-fi movie because it could never happen in real life, and it's a sci-fi movie. So he says this repeatedly. He's like, that shit would never happen. That is my sci-fi movie. And I'm like, you know what? Alyssa Jones is the greatest sci-fi female kick-ass character of all time. Like, she put Affleck in his place.
I haven't seen that movie in decades.
That's great.
So I'm going to go off topic. I got to ask you a question. Mel, the Emmys nominations from today, have you had a chance to mull them over?
Yeah, I mean, I saw a little bit about them. And, you know, obviously it's super exciting that Netflix got more, you know, nominations again. But one of my friends on Facebook pointed out Hannibal wasn't nominated at all. Does anybody watch that show?
I absolutely love it.
I love that show.
Yeah.
Well, I'm glad somebody else shares my because it's almost like I'm embarrassed in a way to tell people I like it because they just think it's so dark and demented, but I'm like, that's the great thing about it.
Yeah, Mads Mikkelsen is redefined Hannibal Lecter. Like, he is Hannibal Lecter.
He is. He's amazing. And oh my God, that ending! Oh my God.
Yeah, I flipped out.
I'll watch it.
This last season, the opening scene, I've watched like 80 times.
I don't know how they got the whole season 2 on TV, like on broadcast network NBC.
I know. Like, it's so
that's utterly ridiculous.
It is. It's so scary, and oh, I love it. But yeah, so to get back to your question about the Emmys, sorry. I do think they were overlooked there. But overall, very happy with it. I'm sure a lot of people are, happy to see True Detective being nominated. It's interesting to actually know of and have seen all the shows that are in like the best, the nominated for the best show category.
I would have liked to seen The Blacklist get a nomination. But I do understand now, as I look at the nominees, who do you take out? House of Cards, if I was me, I would probably take Mad Men out. I think from what I've heard, people have told me this season has kind of jumped the shark, and it's not, I think that's a safe bet kind of thing. And Breaking Bad's been over. So I don't,
how many more years is that going to get nominated?
I think it's about time they kind of remove that from the list, even though I do know that this is 2013 to 2014. But, I think that there was two other shows that probably did deserve it a little bit more. And I think somebody said to me today, because I was wondering why Ava Green wasn't nominated for Penny Dreadful. And somebody said that they think that Penny Dreadful debuted too late for the Emmys. Well, it's July and the show's over. So when was the damn nominations available? It just doesn't make sense to me.
Was it the end of the year? Because, the Oscars go by December 31st, but I actually don't know what the cutoff is for the Emmys. So that would be sort of a thing for that to figure that out. But because, Penny Dreadful definitely just started and just ended, so maybe it's the sort of thing that it just wasn't eligible.
Well, Homeland deserves shit.
Oh, there's another one, yeah.
That last season was garbage.
I can't watch it. It's too stressful.
The show was really good in the first couple of years, but after that, it was just, my God, it was not worth it. Well, you know what? Normal Heart was nominated. That show just ended a month ago. So
you're right. That just came on. Yeah.
Got overlooked.
And the ones that aggravated me, obviously, Alexandra Daddario, if you're going to crash websites with your performance in True Detectives, give yourself a guest star Emmy if you're crashing websites all over the interwebs. And for comedy, and I don't know how he didn't get nominated, because his scene in the final thing of Silicon Valley is the funniest thing I've seen in probably a decade, T.J. Miller. I don't know how T.J. Miller with his diagram. Do either one of y'all watch Silicon Valley?
Yes.
That whole diagram they went into at the thing where he's drawing on the board and figuring out the algorithm, I was like, how in the world is he not like, I guess being in IT, I know that guy. I've worked with that guy, and it's like, that was one of the funniest characters I've seen in years, and I'm blown away that he didn't get nominated.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Newsroom, but I think it got some, Jane Fonda, fine, I'm okay with that. Jeff Bridges, I'm okay. Jeff
Daniels,
sorry. I'm okay with that. But again, John Hamm, we're going back. You're going to put Woody Harrelson and Matthew McConaughey. If we were talking about the Oscars, what would we be saying about that? They're going to cancel each other out. But I think at this point, Matthew McConaughey probably runs away with that, unless the sentimental value goes to Bryan Cranston.
Yeah.
Or Woody Harrelson mails everyone a bag of weed.
But can we all agree that, the final two on that should be Matthew McConaughey and Kevin Spacey for House of Cards?
Oh, yeah. Spacey was amazing in House of Cards.
And, so was McConaughey.
Oh, exactly, yeah. That would be hard-pressed to choose between those two.
But if you had to, put a gun to your head, who are you giving it to?
Kevin Spacey.
Yeah?
Yeah.
I thought about this all day today, and I was going to lean Kevin Spacey myself. And then I remembered one scene from True Detective, and it kind of has to go to him for me.
Oh.
There's one scene. I don't want to spoil for people that didn't see True Detective. Hopefully everyone will catch up on True Detective, but it's the final episode of the season. I just think his character was just so amazing, and one of the few things that I think Brad and I agree on.
Oh, no, actually, I would vote, like Melissa and I were talking, I would vote for Mads Mikkelsen. He has stolen that character from Anthony Hopkins.
Oh, yeah,
if he was nominated, he would run away with it. But otherwise, yes, I'd give it to Matthew McConaughey.
And how about James Spader not getting a nomination?
Yeah, I think people grew frustrated with that show's writing because you could see where it was going by episode 3. Like, I know, the only reason I watched it was for James Spader's performance, but the writing on that, to me, was just horribly sloppy.
It got sloppy, yes.
It's like they hired the guy that wrote The Last Transformers.
No.
That guy should have been aborted. He's bad, and he's writing some, they just hired him to write some huge movie. I think Disney.
Gotcha, 3.
No, I mean like huge. Like, I think Disney hired him to write something.
Really?
Yeah, like maybe what movie are they doing? Where is our Disney woman?
Doctor Strange?
No, they're doing like a live adaptation of an animated Disney movie. Not Snow on the Seven Dwarfs, not Sleeping Beauty. They're making some, I was reading on, maybe, I don't know, but they hired Erin Kruger. He also wrote the last Nightmare on Elm Street movie with Jackie Earle Haley. He's just a horrible writer, and he must be someone's illegitimate son. That's all I can figure. I don't know how he has a career.
Well, the Emmys are coming up soon. We'll be talking about this for probably a few more months until we see who wins, and it'll be interesting to have that conversation afterwards to see if anybody disagrees with what happens. Most likely it's going to be safe bets all around Modern Family, Breaking Bad, etc. kind of thing. But hopefully I'm wrong and we'll see something change. So make sure you check out the new webpage, Real, R-E-E-L, newsdaily.com. Bliss, do you want to say anything when it goes live or anything?
No, just please comment and let us know everything that you would like to see and let us know what you like and what you don't like.
Yeah, as you will find all the normal content you used to find from us on Cinemint, you'll be there. For those of you wondering, we're still very much in touch with Cinemint.com, but as that site is going through some transitions over the coming months, we decided to take the articles, reviews, and news pieces that you love so much and give them a new place to shine. So we will be still working with Cinemint.com for cross-promotions moving forward, and we look forward to a long and prosperous partnership with them. So that's all we have for you this evening. Thanks again to Mel and Brad for the awesome conversation, and thank you for listening. I'm Michael Petrelli. See you soon. Bye.